This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
What if all your school exams fell on just one day?
This exam determines your entire future. It's a Korean rite of passage.
The whole country comes to a standstill every year as students sit the Sunung. That's the 8-hour college entrance exam.
It's the most anxious and probably stressful test that you can ever have in your life.
I'm Hannah Gelbart, and on What in the World, we're talking about what it's like to sit the Sunung. What in the World is a daily podcast from the BBC World Service. We explain a different topic every weekday in less than 15 minutes, and you can find us wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
When it comes to building our country's infrastructure, we don't take shortcuts. Our fittings are manufactured in an ISO 9001 certified facility, ensuring you get quality products that meet the highest standards. Learn more at vega.us/industrial.
Imagine you live in a village. The sun shines, your crops grow, and you have a small herd of animals, chickens, goats, that provide you with food and an income. But one day, that's all gone. A hurricane drives your village and everything you know underwater. This is the reality for millions of people across the world. Climate change is likely making tropical cyclones more intense, more rain, more wind, and causing them to strengthen quicker. So people have much less time to evacuate.
Currently, we are experiencing a lot of rains. We have landslides, we have flash floods. People's houses have been buried.
Even efforts to rescue people are being hampered by the rains that are falling right now.
Where the landslides have happened, it's mountainous areas, so even going up there is not as easy at the moment.
In 2023, Hurricane Freddy swept through Malawi. Charles and Susan got caught up in the storm.
Around 2 in the morning, we had loud screams from outside, with people screaming, "Water! Water!"
It was all so confusing. I didn't know what to do.
The whole house was flooded with everything inside. So all my animals, all my goats, pigs, my cows, everything went in the floods.
Men, women, children, and the elderly had to climb into trees to escape the rising waters.
At dawn, some boats came and rescued us.
I lost everything, including my spare clothes. The only things I had were the clothes I was actually wearing.
Hurricane Freddy broke records. It was the longest tropical storm ever recorded. It lasted 38 days, and it was among the deadliest in the Southern Hemisphere. People like Susan and Charles have contributed virtually nothing to climate change, and yet they're experiencing its wrath. But now, a year later, they've become among the first people anywhere in the world to receive what some experts are referring to as climate compensation.
This money helped me a lot. I am so excited because I will be in a safe place and I will not have to look over my shoulder in case of any disasters.
I'm so thankful, honestly. I had nothing and no one to turn to.
From the BBC World Service, this is The Climate Question. I'm Greya Jackson, and this is a tale of loss and damage, of justice and money. I'll be following the flow of finance from Scotland to downstream, where I ended up in Malawi, and asking, is it enough? Hello, Ashley. How are you?
Hi, Greya. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good, thanks. You're back from Malawi.
To help me tell this story, I've teamed up with Ashley Lime from BBC Africa.
She's been on the ground reporting in Malawi for us, speaking to Charles and Susan. And she remembers the chaos following Cyclone Freddy well.
And we are looking forward to receive, you know, more support from outside to be able to provide, you know, the required life-saving activity.
Malawi is in a state of disaster. And I appeal to the international community to please look at us with such favor, because we need help.
I remember hearing about it and even watching it in the news. There's a lot of pain and despair among Malawians because a lot of damage had been done on houses, on roads. I remember even the news report saying that about 6 months' rain was actually dumped in that country in just 6 days.
I mean, it sounds awful. You went to visit one of the worst hit areas a little, was it about a year later?
That was a year later, and we were going to Nsanje, which is a district in the southern part of Malawi. It's actually an 8-hour drive south from the capital, Lilongwe.
This is where she met cyclone survivors, Suzanne and Charles.
When we arrived, this whole place was very bushy, very thorny and difficult to live in. We cleared the land and made a house from plastic sheets. The reality of moving from a proper house was difficult. Losing everything and living in a plastic house was very, very hard.
When we got here, it was hard to settle. We had absolutely nothing. Some well-wishers gave me clothes to change into. I had worked so hard, so it was the most painful thing to lose everything all at once.
We did receive the warnings, yes, but we were very reluctant to move. We were like, this is the land of our forefathers. The waters have never washed us away. Little did we know that one day a big flood would come.
We were given early warnings telling us to relocate, but we couldn't. Moving required a lot of money, so we stayed until the flood happened.
I think it's also worth pointing out that before 2015, Malawi had never even seen a cyclone before. There'd never been one.
Yeah, sure, that is really true. But unfortunately, years down the line, in 2022, there was Cyclone Anna, and in 2023, there was Cyclone Freddy. And this has actually been so devastating for these people because the climate shocks were just coming one after the other. And we know that Malawi is actually one of the poorest countries in Africa. So it's actually important that they get funding to be able to move forward and rebuild their lives.
Thank you so much, Ashley. We'll come back to you in a minute to hear what impact this money had on Suzanne and Charles. Now, these funds originally came from the government of Scotland. That's because Scotland and Malawi share more than 100 years of history. Scotland pledged $1.3 million of loss and damage money to the African nation back when it hosted this huge climate conference called COP in Glasgow in 2021. It's the first time this kind of compensatory money has ever been given. The First Minister of Scotland, John Swinney, told me more.
Scotland has always been a country with an international outlook, and we have tried over many years to reflect that in our policy priorities, indeed, particularly with some programmes supporting Malawi. So we've had a history of looking outwards to recognise our international obligations to help and assist development in other countries.
And for anyone who's not familiar with what loss and damage is, could you just help them understand the importance of it and what it does?
What loss and damage is all about is that it recognises the impact of factors that are out with the control of countries, predominantly in the global south, who have not contributed to the climate emergency in the way that those of us in the developed west have contributed to the climate crisis, to essentially receive support to enable them to withstand some of the consequences of climate change.
Right. I mean, some people call it payback. Some people call it climate justice. Some people call it
compensation, though there is some reluctance to call it that. Politically, it's very hard to spend money elsewhere when there's so much else going on in the world, the cost of living crisis, various wars. I mean, how did your government address that potentially politically difficult challenge?
I think we've managed to do it because of the depth of commitment that there has been to the whole concept of international development in Scotland. And I think what's been striking to me is that that has been broadly supported across the political spectrum. Now, there will, of course, be people here in Scotland that will criticise us for the expenditure that we're making on loss and damage, because they will say, well, we could be spending that money here to tackle the climate emergency. I take a different view. I take a view that I think is consistent with the long-term international moral obligations of Scotland as a responsible international player, that we should, yes, get our own house in order, but we should also support others in facing the challenges that they face.
We'll come back to the First Minister in a bit, because I need to remind everyone that they're listening to The Climate Question from the BBC World Service.
What if all your school exams fell on just one day?
This exam determines your entire future. It's a Korean rite of passage.
The whole country comes to a standstill every year as students sit the Sunung. That's the 8-hour college entrance exam.
It's the most anxious and probably stressful test that you can ever have in your life.
I'm Hannah Gelbart, and on What in the World, we're talking about what it's like to sit the Sunung. What in the World is a daily podcast from the BBC World Service. We explain a different topic every weekday in less than 15 minutes, and you can find us wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Save on holiday favorites at Safeway. This week at Safeway, get a free Signature Farms whole frozen turkey, grade A, with a minimum purchase of $150 or more in a single transaction. Member price, limit one offer per household. Plus, get 12 ounces of Oscar Mayer bacon for $3.97 each with digital coupon. Limit four. Also this week at Safeway, Lucerne milk, half gallons, selected varieties are $2.47 each with digital coupon. Limit two. Visit Safeway.com or head in store for more deals.
I'm Greya Jackson. This week, a story of climate justice, of payback. We're following the money. Scotland sent a little over $1 million to Malawi via a charity called Give Directly. Give Directly matched the funds and then funneled the money to people. People like Suzanne and Charles to help them rebuild after the cyclone. Charles and Suzanne, they received around $1,000 in total each. And our reporter, Ashley Lime, spoke to them about what they'd spent the money on.
We were given phones and helped to open mobile money accounts. Then we were given vouchers with details on how we would get the money. So I got 255,000 kwacha first, then 525,000 kwacha, and finally 498,000 kwacha as the last installment.
What do you use the money for?
This money helped me a lot. First, I bought household materials again, since I had lost everything. I also bought clothes and food. With the second installment, I bought sheets of iron and then started making bricks for building, as you can see. The third installment is what I am using to finish this house, buying wood and all that's required so I can complete it. I hope to finish construction work in 10 days.
When we met Susan, she was actually sweeping her compound. Susan is this tall, dark, strong African woman. Like we usually say in Africa, like you have your body energy, like you can still work, you know. So Susan was that kind of a woman. Her house was actually a structure, but not really fully finished, because some of the money that she had was spent on food. There was a lot of hunger after Cyclone Freddy hit and the flooding came. So her children were hungry. She was hungry too. She needed to buy clothing. So there were a lot of needs as a result of what they went through, meaning the more money is required for them to resettle and to build up their lives to what they were in the past.
I must be honest, it was hard.
especially for me. I was independent financially and doing very well with my life, but I lost everything and left everything behind to come here. There are also times I wish I could go back, but this money is like a starter pack. I have a new home, a new life. I have plenty of needs, yes, but hey, I have a home, and for that, I am grateful.
You know, there's a lot of value that is attached to ancestral homes when you come to Africa. And that was actually the main reason why she found it really hard to move, leaving your ancestors' graves, because that memory of the graves will actually have been wiped out.
I hadn't ever considered that. That must be such an awful feeling to think you've lost that connection to your ancestors. Obviously, we're talking about things here that are irreplaceable, that can never really be compensated. So there's never going to be a perfect solution. That said, I did wonder whether things could have been done better. Like, why couldn't Charles and Suzanne have had more money? Then they'd been able to finish their new homes and buy back their livestock. It's something I put to the First Minister of Scotland, John Swinney.
There's always a sensitive judgment about the scale of resources that are allocated. I'm pleased to hear that Charles and Suzanne have had the experience of receiving that support. And I think what I want to make sure is that in all the programmes we're taking forward, we are satisfied that they are making a beneficial effect as a consequence. Now, we've been able to increase our funding to address loss and damage to £10 million in total.
I think one of the other difficulties was that Charles and Suzanne had to wait 6 months before they received the money, so 6 months after the cyclone. And I wonder whether you think it might ever be possible to receive the money just after an event, or perhaps even before the cyclone hits.
We've got to be supportive of getting resources in place as quickly as we possibly can do after particular events. I don't think it'd be possible to do it before cyclone events. I think we'd have to wait to see what the impact would be. But there is another aspect to our loss and damage activity, which is that we've got to be trying to equip areas to withstand challenges arising from the climate. And that's where our resources can be used in a preventative way to try to avoid crises emerging. And I think that's a really important characteristic of the approach that we need to take to the delivery of loss and damage support, that we find ways of acting in a preventative, early intervention way to make sure that the capacity and the capability of areas are strengthened to withstand the challenges that they might face.
Loss and damage, or compensation, is just one type of climate finance officials talk about at these huge climate conferences called COP. Rich polluting countries have, in the past, pledged money to countries like Malawi to help them to adapt to the effects of a warming world and to fight climate change itself. Those pledges have been pretty problematic, though, as Ashley Lime has been finding out.
I spoke to Dominic Nyasuru, who's the National Youth Network on Climate Change National Coordinator. Dominic told me that Malawians are really frustrated because the money is taking too long to get to people, and therefore there are more climate shocks that are coming as a result of this.
So actually Malawians are really frustrated because the money is getting too long to be accessed. And this is very difficult because the more we delay, the more other shocks are coming, which means that the costs are also increasing. So we need to treat these issues with urgency. My message is that, you know, as a country, loss and damage is a big issue. We have seen a lot of losses. We have seen a lot of damages. And the loss and damage is our priority. Access of these resources are very difficult because of the conditions that are associated with these funds. So definitely we need these funds to come as grants and not loans, which is one of the issues that we are advocating for. As a country, we are much more indebted because of impacts of climate change. So we believe that at the end of the day, we need also these funds to be actually adequate, predictable, But also we need to have a simplified access to this funding that will be discussed during COP29, which is happening in November this year.
Dominic has a lot of concerns there about climate financing more broadly. So not just the loss and damage fund we've been hearing about this week, but as I said before, money to adapt and to fight climate change. And so there's a lot of mistrust and bitterness between countries at the COP29 climate conference in Azerbaijan. And that matters for people like Suzanne and Charles, because it's here that the world will try to agree a new annual financial target for 2025 onwards. How much of this money will be there to protect them from future floods or to help them switch to cleaner cooking fuels? That's what's at stake in Baku. But Scotland's First Minister is somewhat optimistic.
There's been a huge amount of innovation on this subject, and when I think back to those discussions, they were embryonic, they were aspirational. Just the other week there, I addressed a Global Ethical Finance Initiative summit in Edinburgh, attended by about 300 significant players from within the ethical finance community around the world, all of whom interested in pooling resources to make sure the effectiveness of their investments would be clear to see. So I suppose the moral of the story I take is that if you're prepared to be committed to these journeys, to create new finance initiatives that might enable us to support countries to undertake their development, then we should be prepared to do so.
First Minister, one of the concerns that was raised by one of our guests, Dominic, was that a lot of the financing is coming in the form of loans as opposed to grants, like in Malawi's case this time. And so I wonder whether there's going to be any movement, do you think, on that this year at COP?
We try to put as much of our effort as we can in the form of grants to enable the long-term rebuilding of societies. We would try in our programmes to try to avoid the use of loans as much as we possibly can do.
And I wonder what your message is to other countries who are trying to do similar loss and damage schemes to get that over the line politically.
My advice would be that this is all part of the importance of building bridges within our world today. The world is a fractious place at this moment. It is probably more fractious than I have seen in my lifetime, and that's deeply concerning. So what loss and damage provides us with the opportunity to do, as I believe international development does, is to build relationships, to build cooperation between countries. We need more of that.
First Minister John Swinney, it's been an absolute honour talking to you. Thank you so much for making the time.
Thank you very much.
Before we sign off, I think for me, I've learned that the mechanics of money can be really simple, but the politics are hard. Making governments cough up cash in such uncertain times is really tough, and that's the crux of the issue here. But as we've seen from Scotland, it's not impossible.
Survivor Charles was very excited to speak to me. He was showing me pieces of wood that he was going to use to make window and door frames in his new house. So there was so much relief and excitement around Charles.
I am happy to be here, simply because we are in a very safe place to live. We do not have to worry about floods anymore, since we are now living in the uplands. It feels so good not to worry about the flooding.
I bet it does, Charles. Thank you so much to both Charles and Susan for sharing their stories with us. If you have a climate question about COP, climate finance, anything really, or perhaps some feedback, you can WhatsApp us on +44 800 321 721, or you can email us. It's theclimatequestion@bbc.com. Remember, both those contact details are in the episode description and our website.
Thank you also to our production team this week. They were Anna Kumu, Octavia Woodward, Simon Watts, and Tom Bricknell. I'm Greg Jackson, and that was The Climate Question.
What if all your school exams fell on just one day?
This exam determines your entire future. It's a Korean rite of passage.
The whole country comes to a standstill every year as students sit the Sunung. That's the 8-hour college entrance exam.
It's the most anxious and probably stressful test that you can ever have in your life.
I'm Hannah Gelbart, and on What in the World, we're talking about what it's like to sit the Sunung. What in the World is a daily podcast from the BBC World Service. We explain a different topic every weekday in less than 15 minutes, and you can find us wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Curious about investing in crypto and not sure where to start? Start with Grayscale. They have over a decade of experience focused on this emerging asset class. In fact, Grayscale operates over 20 different crypto investment products, offering investors plenty of choice when it comes to diversifying into crypto. Even better, many of their products are available right in your investment account. Give it a try. Search for a Grayscale product ticker today. Investing involves risk, including loss of principal. For more information and important disclosures, visit grayscale.com.